Navigating the multi-generational workplace seems so complicated. With Gen Z and now Gen Alpha joining the team, how do we stay ahead of the curve while honoring the values of all our employees?
Hi, I'm Dr. Steven Stein, clinical psychologist, emotional intelligence expert, and founder of MHS, a leading publisher of scientific, psychological assessments, and talent development solutions. From Gen Alpha to baby boomers, we're dealing with more generations in the workforce than ever before. But luckily, we may have more in common than you think. So stay tuned. We're living in a time when six different generations are clocking in at the same workplace. From the fresh-faced Gen Alphas gearing up for their first job, to the silent generation, who still have a few members who are just entering retirement. When we start talking about how generational experiences shape our approach to work, there may be more to consider than age alone. Recently, here at MHS, we conducted a study looking at our change style indicator to try and understand how different age groups approach change. We were pretty surprised to find that the results showed no connection between age and preferred change style. Gen Z can be just as hesitant to change as their baby boomer colleagues. And every generation has its fair share of folks who are all about embracing the new. So if we can't just target our strategies based on age, where does that leave us? That's the question our guest, Heather McGowan, has dedicated her career to. She's a keynote speaker and future work strategist who has learned that if we want to appeal to a multitude of demographics, we need to look at the bigger picture. Hey, Heather, it's great to meet you and really excited to have you here with us on the podcast. Why don't we begin by sharing a little bit about yourself and your work?
First, thanks for having me. Great to be here. I make my living now as a keynote speaker, and it sort of evolved out of working on the supply and the demand side of talent. So I was working in higher ed across 3-4 different institutions over 10, 12 years. And finding myself in that environment, explaining why we needed to think differently about how we educate people for the workforce. I was also doing white space exploration innovation work for corporations, and their workforce wasn't prepared to find and frame new challenges. They were only prepared to execute on the known. So from the supply and the demand side, I spent most of my time explaining to folks how I saw work changing, not only changing in the future, but how it had already changed. And then that sort of became its own thing. So that's how I got to this moment.
Okay, well, today's episode's all about changing demographics and basically the future of the workforce. But before we get into that, I think we want to have an understanding of what the workforce is looking like today. So based on your experience, how would you describe the current workforce?
Well, we've got a multi-generational workforce, and that may or may not be relevant because generations are not a monolith. They're not all the same. We only kind of delineate generations because they've got different cultural experiences. And in my view, they have different work promises as well. So boomers are probably the last generation that might believe that they trade their loyalty for security. That was the work promise of work. And that hasn't been true for decades. And Generation Z, which is now going to be 30% of the workforce soon, came into it with, we're on our own. There's no promise. It's what have you done for me lately? And I think we've got a workforce that stretches across those two sort of tacit promises or agreements. And then we have a big disruptor that, as far as I can tell, a lot of people want to stop talking about, which was the pandemic. And I think it doesn't make sense to talk about something that was so profoundly disrupting, because I think what it did is it was a bit of an existential crisis for folks. And it caused folks to say, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? Why have I dedicated so much of my life to this? I don't like where I work, or I do like where I work. I have to check myself at the door, or I can be my full authentic self. This is an expression of my values. This is the kind of impact I have on the world. Or this isn't. I hold my nose when I go in the office every day. And so that question, that existential question, I think started happening for a lot of folks. I think people get confused about where work takes place, because I think that is a grand experiment that's going to take much more time to figure out. When do we need to go in an office? When do we need to get together? What work do we do better on our own? We actually take remote work and the existential crisis together, I remember the first year of the pandemic. Well, many of us who couldn't work in person or didn't need to work in person were working from home. I would talk to different people from different generations because they had different experiences with technology, different experiences what they were comfortable with. And it was, at that time, we didn't have too many Gen Z in the workforce. It was more millennials. Millennials were like, I'm totally comfortable. Boomers were like, this can't work. I have to be in person, blah, blah, blah. Fast forward to about a year or two later, boomers had gotten comfortable with it. They'd bought a house somewhere. They were easing towards retirement. They liked working remotely. And they're like, no, working from home is great. We can do everything, because they were working from their house in Tahoe or whatever. And then Gen Zs had entered the workforce at that point, and they were totally comfortable with being remote, but they knew that they needed more mentoring and guidance and connection. So it was the younger generation that was fully literate in the digital technologies that wanted to be in the office. And it was the older generation that had become literate, but also had been much more comfortable having much more of their free time. So it was interesting to see how those two things intersected. But I think the existential crisis has also led to this sort of purpose revolution. And I think that's happening for a couple of reasons. One, I think the pandemic caused us to question what we do with our time and our lives and the fragility of life. But also we have a loneliness epidemic, and a loneliness epidemic coming to head at the same time as we've got a lot of societal and cultural changes. So what our social fabric used to be, where we got belonging, whether it was church or clubs or getting together with our neighbors, all of those things have reduced. We're spending more and more time alone. More of us live alone. More of us have our single parents. Just across every single demographic, we're spending more and more time alone. So people started looking for more and more meaning from the one place that most of us spend a big bulk of their time, and that's work. And I think those two things came together, cause more folks to say, my work has to be my meaning. It has to be my purpose. It has to be my belonging. It has to be my self-expression. And I think that's one of the things that's driving sort of a purpose revolution at work.
Oh, I love that. And I want to get back to that a little later on. I want to cycle back to this thing about Gen Zs. What can you say about the different ways that the Gen Zs approach work today?
Again, they're not a monolith. My friend David Allison studies values, and he is very anti using demographics, because he says demographics divide and value graphics unite. And I don't disagree with him. And I think he has some expression, I'm going to get it wrong, but it's something like, you may have more in common with people who eat ketchup than the people who were born at the same time you were. So no, it's something like that. No generation is a monolith, but you do have different experiences. And I think the way I talk about it is, what was the kind of tacit promise around work? What were the ways in which you were educated? What were the expectations? Because I think those things do come in with a little bit of demographic difference. So Generation Z has been through a lot. They were born in 9/11. They never know a time without terrorism. In the US, they went through mass school shootings, whether they happened at their school or not, all of this in the backdrop of social media. They went through the global financial crisis. Some of them are depression era baby-esque in their outlook in terms of finances. They finished their education, they entered the workforce in a global pandemic. They have double the rates of anxiety and depression. 80% of them report being lonely, whereas 50% of all adults report being lonely. So they have different profiles based upon different sets of experiences. They've been accused of being slow to adult. They're also our most diverse and most well-educated generation. They're likely to be our most entrepreneurial, whether they're actual entrepreneurs or they're entrepreneurial in their work. They're the most earnest and the least likely to check their values at the door. But you know what? That's probably true of every generation when they enter. When they go from being dependent to independent adults and they enter the workforce, we'll see if that sustains. I'm very optimistic. I think they're going to change work in interesting ways, because I think we have a workplace that got rules and values that were set in part by the silent generation, but also by the boomers. And it was around that sort of tacit and unfulfilled promise that you're going to trade your loyalty for security, because none of us have that security anymore. And we can't be expected to give that loyalty if the promise isn't there.
Yeah, you know, I sort of see where you're coming from. We did a study here at MHS using our change style indicator across generations, which looks at your sort of ways of dealing with change or adapting to change. And we found minimal difference between the age groups, which was surprising, but it goes along with what you're saying. So the difference between generations may not be as large as we think. And I really like what you're saying about purpose-driven work and where things are headed today. How could we look beyond age into this area and maybe other areas that is really needed for employees?
I think more than anything else, whatever generation you may be, is we need to have folks feel seen and heard. I think I do some speaking, and it's not full talks yet. It's portions of talks around how we can get organizational cohesion, because we're so politically divided in this country. And it's really been a wedge that I think is unnecessary. And I think it comes from certain parts of the population not feeling seen and heard. And also from this social media, which is designed to drive a wedge between us because it's simply profitable to do. Because if you take anybody, any two people off the street, and you sit them down with a cup of coffee, I guarantee you they will find more in common than they have find in difference. But if you start by saying, I am an X, I'm a Democrat, I'm a Republican, I'm a Biden person, I'm a Trump person, I'm a whatever those labels we use, that immediately starts with division. But if we start with, I'm a parent, I am a surfer, I am a reader, I am a bike rider, I am a Christian, whatever, how other ways in which you define yourself, you might find ways to talk to people. Because I think David Brooks uses the terms, I know one of its weavers and the other one's rippers. In our society, we need more weavers, and we've had some folks who are more rippers. And I think with work being the last place that people are still looking for belonging, and as technology comes in and consumes more routine and predictable tasks, which is really individual tasks, the work we're going to be doing is collaborative exploration requires that we see and hear each other, that we make connections, that we listen to people's diverse and different opinions, because that makes for better ideas. So I think the number one thing we need to do in work, whether we're talking about demographics or we're talking about racial differences or cultural differences, is listen to each other. People need to feel seen and heard. You won't get to purpose if you don't listen to folks first.
I like that. I like that, weavers and trying to find common ground. I think that's so important. And I guess we're not seeing a whole lot of that today, which is really important. So in terms of the person looking for a job or a new career, what are some of the common factors they could consider when they're making those kinds of decisions of where they want to work and the kind of work they want to do?
Don't look for a job, because whatever job you're going into is undoubtedly going to change. Look for a boss and a culture. Look for somebody who's going to be your champion, your ally, your corrector, who's going to course correct you, because that's what really helps you grow. Look for an environment where you feel like not just that you fit, but you could add to it, that people believe some of the things that you believe. You feel like you could be your authentic self at work. You feel like that they would respect boundaries around what is your life and what is your work. Because that whole idea of work is your family. No, it's not. Work is a community. You have your own family. I think we've made that mistake in making work everything for people. And I don't think that's appropriate, because what happens if work is your family, if you're summarily laid off one day? I was talking to a friend of mine on Friday, and her company was just dissolved on Friday. Her job was over. They had people work from home, and then they sent them all a message saying, it's over, folks. You wouldn't do that with a family. So let's stop calling work our family.
Yeah, I've heard other people compare work to a sports team, right? Where we make trades and we do new recruits, and we're always doing what we can to be our best. I understand you said in the past that you feel the next big resignation coming will happen to people in the C-suite roles. Is that something you still feel is going to be happening in the near future?
I'm not entirely sure yet. I felt that about a year ago. About a year ago, my book, The Empathy Advantage, came out, and it was about leading the empowered workforce, leading a workforce where we're going to have labor shortages. We still have higher levels of 1.36 jobs for every job opening. The highest it was in the last 20 years was, I think, 1.2 something. So we have a tight labor market. And after all we've been through the last 3-4 years, post-pandemic high, we still have labor shortage. And it's because there's, I think it's 4 million fewer Gen Z than there were millennials, 3 million fewer predicted to be alphas, which is the next generation after Gen Z. So we're seeing a declining population, at least here in the U.S., booming in other parts of the world, but here in the U.S., which means we're going to be constantly struggling to fill positions, because I don't think ChatGPT is going to take over all jobs. It's going to augment all of us. So with a tight labor market, you have to lead differently. And also, most leaders are leading teams of people who have skills and knowledge that they do not. So if you're a leader today, you cannot be an expert on generative AI and cybersecurity and data analytics and everything else, which is now integral to every team. So you can't lead with individual intelligence. You've got to lead with collective intelligence. So around the time I was doing the book tours for The Empathy Advantage, talking to people about leading differently, both because you have an empowered workforce, but also because You're leading people who have some skills and knowledge that you do not. When I was talking about empathy, I was hitting wall after wall with people saying, yeah, we've had it with empathy. We were empathetic for 3 years. We're exhausted. Just get back to work. I don't want to hear about your problems. Because they were conflating empathy and sympathy and empathy and compassion. One person in an interview said to me, yeah, I know. I have to hear about all your problems and expect less of you. And I said, that's not what empathy is at all. Empathy is trying to understand your people so you can help them become self-propelled, help them unlock their potential. It's actually leading to higher performance, not lower performance. But that fatigue I was hitting time and time again, I thought, the teams that led us, the leaders that led us through the pandemic, which was absolutely unprecedented, you don't get two of those in a career, may say, enough. If we've got, especially when they were looking at a recession coming. So they were looking at, okay, I brought you through a pandemic. Now I'm looking at a recession. I am checking out. I'm not doing two crises. So I felt a wave of folks looking to step out. I don't know yet if that's going to be true, but at the time it felt very much like we were going to start having a lot of resignations.
Heather's differentiation between empathy and sympathy sheds light on a fundamental aspect of effective leadership. It's not just about mastering our craft, but also understanding the intricacies of human interaction within our teams. The pandemic served as a wake-up call, reminding us of the importance of prioritizing the human experience in the workplace. In the face of uncertainty, empathy emerges as the key to navigating change and fostering resilience. Emotional intelligence, as Heather will explain, is now indispensable for leaders. It's not merely a nice to have, but a prerequisite for success in today's dynamic landscape.
Yeah, so we have socialized our leaders with the promise that they would work their way up with levels of experience based upon their expertise. So they would be that unquestioned expert. So they could make decisions in certainty. Everybody would report to them. They would structure and position the work and they would make sure it got done. And that was the leader. You were unquestioned. And now with the rate of change, particularly with things like AI coming in, suddenly that leader can't be. If you have a leader who's an unquestioned expert, they're a liability. So suddenly the profile we socialized is actually a liability. So now we need more and more leaders who can get comfortable saying, I don't know, let's find out. What do you think? I have to consult with other people who can harness collective intelligence. And that it takes a different, they have to be authentic. They have to know when to be vulnerable. They have to know when to defer. And that's a pretty big shift from the way we've been socializing leadership for the last few decades.
Sounds like you're recommending things like curiosity, teamwork, working together. So if we have leaders out there listening now who are wondering where they're going from here, what do you think should be front of mind for those leaders who are trying to make this transition into the new workplace?
I think the best way to think about leaders now is to think of them as like coaches. If you think of like a really elite coach, and like Phil Jackson's one of my favorite. I thought Sacred Hoops was one of the best management books ever written, even though it was written long before any of these technologies and stuff. He came in, I lived in Chicago at the time, I was a big Bulls fan, but he did it again in LA and he's done it repeatedly. He's got more championship rings than anybody else for a reason. He goes into a situation and says, okay, who are these personalities? How do I get the best out of them? How do we get them to want to get the best out of each other? And one of my mantras is that we used to do peers as competitors and we need to shift to peers as collaborators. Like we're only going to win together. And so he went in and took a Rodney, you know, a Michael Jordan and a Scottie Pippen and could take these personalities and get them to, when they're naturally wanting to be competitors, to be collaborators and work together. And that's not an easy thing. And he did it by deeply understanding his people and coming up with different agreements for them with fairness, so that they could work together. And I think that's the approach now. You have to think about yourself as a coach to a series of elite athletes that want to compete with each other. It's inherent to them, but you got to help them to get focused on competing together.
And it sounds like a big part of that that you're referring to is that empathy. Again, we keep coming back to the empathy. So in terms of people who maybe, and I know you've been dealing with this, who aren't aware or not fully on board, or even those who want to get more empathic in terms of their working with people, how would you tell them to start being more empathic? What would be the direction for them to go?
when they're resistant to it, I say, well, how's it going? And they're like, it's not. I'm like, okay, let's start there. If it's working the way you're doing it, I could be wrong. Continue on. If it's not working and you're frustrated, how do you try to understand that person? Who's the person who's making you the most uncomfortable? Your efforts to change them have not worked so far, right? And they're like, yes. Okay. How can you listen to them? I was speaking to a group of real estate developers. And at the time, and this was like maybe a year or two ago, and there was still boomer leadership. I'm just using the generational terms because it's relevant to how they were relating to each other. They were stereotypically relating to each other. So the boomer leader said, I want everybody in the office. I'm the boss. I call the meetings. He said, half the people don't show up. They call into Zoom. They're not listening to me. I said, it's not going well, right? And he said, right. I said, just try. Just hear me out. Ask them when they want to meet. Ask them to come up with you on the goals. Say, listen, we have to meet this big overarching goal. How are we going to get there? And he deferred a little bit of that unquestioned expert to the team in terms of how they wanted to do it and how they would meet those goals. And he said, suddenly he had people showing up, owning bits of work, driving bits of work that they hadn't had before, because he stepped back from a position that he thought he needed to be in because that's what he had been socialized to do, to say, okay, what if I listen to them? They're obviously working for this high-level real estate development company because they're very ambitious, but you're actually suppressing their ambition when you're telling them when and how they have to do it, as opposed to listening to how they might want to do it. And some of them wanted to use different types of technologies that he wasn't comfortable with. And some of them wanted to do it on a different schedule. And some of them wanted to prioritize other things first in terms of the workflow. And he learned a tremendous amount. He wrote to me a couple of weeks later and he's, I'm just blown away with how productive we've come and how engaged the workforce is. Because once he stopped trying to control everything and allowed them to use some of their natural ambition, because one of the things I say is purpose is ambition. If you help people connect with their purpose, it is a sense of ambition and it is a level of energy you're not going to get anywhere else.
So I can guess at this, but looking ahead, there's a lot of sort of critical factors we can identify for organizations to look at as they want to have a more, I don't know, inclusive and thriving workplace to really support their employees. What do you see are some of the most important things that organizations should look for in terms of supporting everyone, diverse age, demographics, cultural groups, to be the most supportive they can be? What are the critical factors?
One of the things I think people look for lately is engagement. I think engagement is a good, really good, helpful factor. But I think engagement is a little bit of a lagging, not a leading indicator. Engagement works when you have people who feel seen and heard, who feel like they have an environment of trust and psychological safety, who feel like a connection to shared purpose. When you have those things, then you get engagement. You can't start with engagement. You've got to build your way back. Do people feel like they're seen and heard? And there's lots of studies that people will leave an organization if they don't have a best friend, they don't feel like their boss respects them or sees and hears them. There's a lot of evidence that first piece is really important. Do I feel like people know who I am and why I'm here and what I care about in an environment? And I think we need to start a little further back than just things like engagement.
So engagement seems like more of an outcome, and it's really how the building blocks to get there that you're talking about. Heather, this has been great speaking with you and getting your views on all these things, and they really resonate with us, and I'm sure they will with our audience. We always like to end the show with one question, and that is, if you could summarize the future of work in one word, what would that be and why?
I'm going to cheat and use two with a hyphen maybe, collaborative exploration. Because I think once technology consumes a routine and predictable task, which it will because it'll be cheaper for it to be done by technology and it will remove the exhaustion and friction from us, what's left is finding and framing new challenges. What's left is exploration. And we're not going to do that on our own. We're going to do that together. So it's collaborative exploration. I think that is the future of work. It's going to be it probably tomorrow, the next day, for the next decade. And it's going to mean we're going to need to see and hear each other. We're going to need to empathize with each other. We're going to need to create connection. We're going to need to create shared purpose. We're going to need to help motivate ourselves and each other. We're going to have to help each other adapt to change, because we're going to be going out there and finding and framing the new challenges and creating new value.
That's great, Heather. I think we can all buckle up and get ready for that future where we're going to be doing it together. We're all in this boat together, and you'll help us lead the way. Heather, for those of our listeners who are interested in learning more about your work, because it sounds fascinating, why don't you tell us where they can find out more about you?
Sure. So there's a lot of stuff on my website, and that is heathermcgowan.com. You can put that in the show notes. And on there, I have speaking topics. I have links to my books, The Empathy Advantage, and before that, The Adaptation Advantage. You can also go and find me on YouTube, where I take little clips of different concepts that I explain in my talks, which usually include visuals. And they're somewhere between 1 and 3 minutes. I'm also on LinkedIn, which is my learning community. So find me, join me on LinkedIn. I post what I'm reading. Other people tag me and stuff that I should be reading. So that's my learning community. So it's LinkedIn, it's my website, it's my books, and it's YouTube. And I learn from you. So anything I said today that you don't agree with, I'd love to hear from you, because that is my greatest source of learning is when I'm correct.
That's great. Thanks, Heather. Great meeting you, and good luck with your work.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on your show.
So the verdict is in. It turns out the changing workforce has less to do with our generational preferences and everything to do with our own experiences and values. Heather's insights ask us to reconsider our approach. Rather than focusing on accommodating different generations, we should prioritize aligning talent with our shared purpose. Given the significant amount of time we devote to our professional lives, finding fulfillment in our work is paramount. It's time to embrace change and learn how we can be a little more empathic, both to ourselves and our coworkers. If you are keen on delving deeper into Heather's expertise or ways to build your emotional intelligence, check out the resources linked in our show notes. And if you enjoyed the podcast, make sure to subscribe and review us on Apple Podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks for joining us.